You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Last Samurai, a carefully considered rant. Or, is there honor in slavery? The Last Samurai, a 2003 film, was an enjoyable historical adventure with a good script, decent martial arts choreography, and great acting. However, as in many historical films, the history is not accurately depicted. As a matter of fact, the history is so inaccurate that it is frequently exactly backwards, with what anyone with a brain and a conscience would call the good guys depicted as the bad guys, and vice versa. Here's a quick story synopsis. Captain Nathan Algren, a decorated American veteran of the Indian Wars of the late 1800s, is hired by the government of Japan to train the Japanese army in modern weapons and tactics in order to combat rebels who were engaged in an uprising against the government. Algren is wounded and captured by the rebels, who nurse him back to health. He grows to admire their warrior culture and to sympathize with their cause, finally fighting alongside them in their noble but doomed rebellion. The movie begins with a voiceover from an actor with a noble-sounding upper-class British accent, in which the narrator says that Japan was made by a handful of brave men, warriors willing to give their lives for what seems to have become a forgotten word, honor. As these solemn words are uttered, the camera pans across the landscape to settle on the rebel leader, Lord Katsumoto, seated in meditation on a hillside, overlooking some of his peasants working in the fields. These words, juxtaposed with this image, offer an unintentional and ironic commentary on the twisted and revisionist history depicted in this film. In the mid-1860s, Meiji, the Emperor of Japan, did something that no Japanese emperor had done for many centuries. He seized political control of the government from the military dictator, or shogun. For centuries, the emperor had been essentially a figurehead with no political power. Meiji and his supporters took back the power and began efforts to modernize Japan. The movie portrays this modernization as an attempt by ruthless capitalists, among Meiji's advisors, to destroy a beautiful spiritual way of life that was dedicated to discipline, honor, and being in tune with nature. Sort of like the story in the sci-fi movie Avatar. Of course, as with much historical fiction, there are elements of truth here. Some of Meiji's advisors were budding capitalists who wanted to set themselves up to profit from Meiji's reforms, and no doubt some of them were less than savory characters. Among the goals of the reformers was the abolition of the samurai class, which is depicted in the movie as following an idealized lifestyle of discipline, honor, and a love of the arts and nature. What is not made clear in the movie is that the samurai class was made up of only a very small percentage of the population and enjoyed privileges that were denied to the rest of Japanese society. This was due to the caste system, which was in place at the time in Japan. This system divided society into various classes or castes that legally confined a person to the caste into which he or she was born. Once born, there was virtually no chance of becoming a member of a different caste, no matter how much talent and ability one possessed. The top caste, the nobility, were the samurai. Most samurai families owned land that was worked by peasants who were little more than slaves. Each member of the samurai class, who had the available time to practice martial arts and the leisure time to enjoy the beauty of poetry, art, drama, calligraphy, or the tea ceremony, had that free time specifically because of the endless back-breaking manual labor of the peasants, who called them lord or lady. These peasants labored to such an extent that even if they had known how to practice these arts, they would not have had the equipment, time, or energy to do so. The Emperor Meiji was essentially the Abraham Lincoln of Japan. He emancipated the lower classes. By abolishing the caste system, he not only abolished the samurai caste, he abolished the peasant class, and all the others, including the Burakumin, or untouchables, who inhabited the very lowest stratum of society. As a direct result of the reforms of the emperor, any Japanese person was free to pursue any destiny to which their talents could lead. Let's do a thought experiment. Imagine a retelling of the story in a different setting, in which the Tom Cruise character is a European military advisor, not an American, and he's assisting in the training of Union troops during the American Civil War. He's wounded and captured in battle by Confederate forces. The Confederate commander, intrigued by his valor in combat and his foreign uniform, takes him to his plantation to heal from his wounds. While convalescing, the hero is struck deeply by the manly martial virtues and code of honor displayed by the Southern aristocracy, and by the bucolic natural beauty of the plantation, unsullied by the ugly coal-fired factories of the North. His impression is so profound that he joins the Confederate Army to assist in their struggle against Yankee oppression. No mention is made of the multitude of African-American slaves upon whose back-breaking toil the beauty and leisure of the plantation depended. Getting back to the film, there's a poignant scene in which the samurai lord Katsumoto's son, Nobutada, is brutalized by government soldiers, who humiliate him by cutting off his topknot, a hairstyle previously only allowed for the samurai class. What is not depicted is the history behind this scene. Centuries of peasants being brutalized and exploited by the samurai class so that they could enjoy their cultural and martial arts. It was perfectly legal for a samurai to kill one of his peasants for any reason, even on a whim. The soldiers in the film who humiliate Nobutada are mathematically most likely to have come from the peasant class. Now, this doesn't forgive the brutality depicted in the scene, but it does make it a bit more understandable. Another example of playing fast and loose with the truth in this film is the depiction of the rebellion itself. The film shows scenes of government soldiers in modern uniforms using artillery fire, rapid-firing Gatling guns, and formations of riflemen mowing down valiant but doomed armor-clad rebels who are wielding swords, spears, bows and arrows, and operating with medieval tactics. Modern warfare seems to be conflated with evil, faceless industrialization. Again, there's a grain of truth here, but a small one. The rebellion depicted was called the Satsuma Rebellion, and some of the rebels did indeed wield swords and wear bits of armor. But the truth is that the vast majority of the rebel soldiers wore uniforms so similar to those of the government troops that they had to wear armbands in order to distinguish themselves from the enemy. Another truth is that most of them carried firearms, and that the rebels even had artillery units of their own. The rebellion was doomed not because the rebels' methods and equipment was outdated. They were simply hugely outnumbered. The government was able to conscript vast numbers of the newly freed peasants, many of whom were more than happy to help put down their numerically inferior former masters. A related, misleading, and somewhat racist idea that the film confers is that the Japanese were primitively unfamiliar with firearms. The truth is that firearms were introduced to Japan in 1453 by the Portuguese, more than four centuries before the events depicted in the movie. The Japanese quickly figured out how to make their own firearms, improving many features through their own ingenuity. Towards the end of a century and a half of incessant warfare, by 1590, Japanese warlords were using formations of thousands of musket-wielding troops. As a matter of fact, many historians think that at that point in history, there were more guns and better guns in Japan than anywhere else on the planet. The historical truth is that by the time of the events in this movie, there had been firearms in Japan for centuries. What had been missing for more than 250 years was warfare. Most of the guns were dusty museum pieces by this point. Another ironic feature of this film emerges when Tom Cruise's character, Nathan Algren, consumed by guilt over his role in massacring Native American women and children during his time in the U.S. Army, and descending into the depths of alcoholism, finds sobriety and peaceful solace among the noble samurai. Their cause is portrayed as pure and honorable, a cause in which Algren's tortured soul can find a morally correct use for his military skills. The irony here lies in a little-known detail of Japanese history. Just as when Europeans landed in the New World and discovered that it was already inhabited by Native Americans, So, when the ancestors of the Japanese first crossed the sea from mainland Asia to what is now Japan, they found Aboriginal people there as well. They called these people Emishi, or nowadays Ainu, and treated them pretty much the same way that Europeans and their descendants treated the Native Americans. The remnants of the Ainu still live in reservations on the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. As a matter of fact, the warrior class, in these early days called Bushi, and later called Samurai, came into being at least partly to be the military instrument for subjugating and exterminating these native people. The military leader of Japan traditionally carried the title Shogun. This had been shortened from Taishogun, which is usually translated as General-in-Chief and Pacifier of Barbarians. Now don't get me wrong. Despite his being a wackaloon Scientologist, I think Tom Cruise is an outstanding actor, and I found his portrayal of a psychologically tortured warrior to be riveting and compelling. The story of personal redemption was inspirational. I thoroughly enjoyed much of the movie. The fight scenes were ripping good. I simply don't see why it was necessary to turn history completely on its head and falsely depict a noble character like the Emperor Meiji in a bad light, simply to service a good story. Oh, and by the way, if not for the Emperor Meiji's abolition of the caste system, Jigoro Kano, born a member of the merchant class, would not have been allowed to become the founder of judo and the grandfather of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.